Well, here we are, the last in our series on shame. And I know what you're thinking, thank God. To which I say, shame on you. Kidding. Hey, gang, at the table back there, you did a great job. Thank you. So the story of Lazarus is much longer than what you heard today. John has a way of embellishing, which I love. But Jesus is told about Lazarus being sick a full 17 verses before, and I knew you needed that information. Before he finally makes his way to the home of Mary and Martha. Now, we're to understand that Jesus kind of took his time. He dawdled getting there. And Martha let him have it once he got there, didn't she? Admonishing him that if he had been there sooner, Lazarus probably would not have died to begin with. And of course, we knew that. We know how this story ends before we even got there, don't we? How many of you could recite it from memory? Really, David? From the beginning? Gotcha. Now, obviously, many scholars see this story as a foreshadowing of Jesus' death and resurrection with good reason. We're given a glimpse of death being defeated even as Lazarus walks out of the cave fully wrapped up. Martha is asked by Jesus to trust him. I got it, Martha. I got it under control. Don't worry. The bottom line is that Jesus is acting in God's time, not in the time implied by our human impatience. Of course, we know that Jesus eventually raises him up, much to the overwhelming relief of his sisters. Now, we're saved the information as to whether or not that stink actually did occur, didn't we? He gets to walk out, and that's all we hear about it. But we do understand that this late in John's gospel, that Jesus returning to Bethany, a nice little suburb outside Jerusalem, is probably going to put him in a lot of danger. He's been targeted by the powers that be, and these most recent examples of his compassion and empathy in God's name have further ticked off those who would eventually hunt him down. Why would he risk his life coming close to the place and the people that would like to see him dead? Coming to Bethany is dangerous and risky. You know, I met with some colleagues this past week because, you know, we have to do that Bible nerd and geek stuff every once in a while, and we started a discussion on what we were doing this Sunday and next week as far as our scintillating and brilliant preaching. That was not funny. Why did you laugh at that? And we got a little giddy. I mean, we all probably agreed that, okay, so Lazarus got to come out of the tomb that day, but he's probably going to die again, right? I mean, what a bummer that is to go through it twice. In other words, it wasn't the beginning of a zombie apocalypse. Sorry, Aaron. Someone suggested that he was probably glad to get away from his nagging sisters, and what a bummer it was when Jesus brought him out, when he thought, oh, God, finally. Then there was the thought that maybe Jesus thought he had more work to do and was just trying to get out of it, so he brought him back. Those were kind of the funny ways of looking at it, but there is something really important that happens in this particular story, besides the fact that this story doesn't show up in any other gospel, but there's something that Jesus does in this gospel that he doesn't do anyplace else, at least that we're not told about. Anybody catch that? Don't make me call on the clergy in the crowd. He weeps. He experiences and understands that this is a major loss for himself and for the people that he loves. He is touched deeply, and so he cries. Now, we may now wonder, if he understood that death cannot be defeated by the love of God, why didn't he just explain that to the sisters? Hey, things will be cool, don't worry about it. Makes us wonder what it is that compels him to bring Lazarus back to life, and it makes us wonder what compels him to help anyone along the way, for that matter. You know, many would say, and yourself may be included, that miracles are a point of faith. Either the ones who believe and have faith get the miracles, or those who witness the miracles get the faith. It's kind of a spiritual and chicken or the egg theory going on there. But I think that the message is more down to earth than just some of Jesus' special magic. This gospel to me has the most profound examples of Jesus in relationship in his world. They are more intimate and they're more emotional than those described by the other gospels, and I am 100% biased, I admit it. I'm also right. These narratives are more descriptive, they're more detailed, they're more colorful. They take forever to hear and to read. But if we take a look at what's going on, his very first miracle in this book is finding more wine, yay Jesus, for a wedding, right? He's coming to the rescue of the wedding party, making the groom look really good. He spends an incredible amount of time with Nicodemus, who comes and sneaks to him in the middle of the night. He's trying to gently prod him to understand what it actually means to be in relationship with God, and whether Nicodemus gets it or not, there's no judgment on Jesus' part. There's just that, okay, now you have the information. We know how much time he spends with the woman at the well because we got to see that yesterday, last week, firsthand with Chad and Lisa. And he is spending time including her, this woman. Who am I that you are coming to me? And in including her, he is also including the rest of the Samaritans that have been rejected by the Jews forever. He creates an incredible controversy on the Sabbath. It's another story where he spends a whole lot of time healing a blind man. And he gets into it, doesn't he? Because he's dumb enough to do it on the day of rest, and he ticks off the Pharisees. And then he has to go and defend the blind man and defend the blind man's parents, all of whom are held accountable for the blind man's blindness because of their sins, blah, blah, blah. He sits in non-judgmental silence when a woman caught in adultery is brought to him. She is wrapped in the shame of her community, and yet he is willing to embrace her with forgiveness, while those who would accuse her would rather see her dead. Mary anoints him with perfume and dries his feet with her hair. Oh, what a scandal that a woman would drop her hair in front of a man. And yet, she does it. And then at the end of John, we have five chapters. Count them, five chapters, which I expect you to go home and read tonight. These discourses where Jesus spends an inordinate amount of time praying for and being with and pleading with and demonstrating to his disciples, regardless of betrayal, regardless of how goofy they can be and not getting what he's saying, he is spending the time with them. Now, obviously, there are numerous other stories and messages, meanings and directions that these stories can take, and we've heard them. But the one thing that looms large in John, and here I have to admit, yes, we see it in the other Gospels too, if not so eloquently, is Jesus' capacity for empathy. That is, putting himself in the shoes of another in order to understand and experience their story and their suffering. Now, according to our dear friend, and she's become a dear friend now, Brené Brown, empathy is the key factor in helping us move out of our shame and helping others move from their shame. If we kind of go back on some of the things that she said, under shame, there are the byproducts of fear, blame, and the big one, disconnection. In order to get courage, compassion, and connection, we have to discover what moves us away from shame and towards resisting shame. Her research has demonstrated over and over again that the greatest way to combat shame is to be able to give, and get this, receive empathy. You know that do unto others thing that you've heard a couple of times as you'd have them do unto you? That one's easy in comparison to love your neighbor as yourself. That one's not so easy. Her research has said over and over and over again that we are looking for reconnection. And that empathy, while it is a word that we toss around, is much more difficult than we realize. We can't fake it, can we? You can't really fake empathy. I would say that what makes it so difficult is that it is almost impossible to relate to another's pain and sense of disconnect if we're afraid to examine our own. Hello? Are you afraid of examining your pain? Thus, loving oneself becomes vital in being able to truly love another. She states, our words are only as effective as our ability to be genuinely present and engage with someone as they tell their story. The skill of empathy, to tap into our own experiences in order to connect with an experience of someone who is relating to us. And this is my favorite definition. Empathy is the ability to perceive a situation from the other's person's perspective, to see, hear, and feel the unique world of the other. Now, this is beyond pity, and it's beyond sympathy. And those, while they touch our hearts, are really sort of distant from another person, whereas empathy asks that we actually sit in the muck with one another. How many want to go sit in the muck? Empathy for others requires that we have the same compassion for ourselves. Let me say that again, and I will say it again. Empathy for ourselves is necessary for us to have in order to demonstrate empathy toward others. From an intellectual or a learning perspective, there are four basic skills. And if I say these to you, you're going to know what they are. The first calls us to see the world as another person sees it, right? Do you ever hear the old adage, perception is reality? And you're looking at someone going, okay, that's your perception. That's your reality. And boy, are you way off. That is not empathy. Just in case you wanted to know, okay? It is about listening to the other person's story and understanding that the story that they're sharing is their reality, and that somewhere, if you are in touch with your reality, you will be able to make connections. There will no doubt be times when you hear a story that you may want to, over-identify and quickly get your story in before they can finish. Not that anybody here would ever do that at all, not even me. The next part is being able to hear a story without being judgmental. And in this day and age, when things are so well with the world and everybody's in agreement about so many things, that's not anything we have to worry about, is it? Being judgmental. I know, I almost threw up a little in my mouth. But chances are we judge ourselves more harshly than we judge anyone else. And the thing of it is, if we judge ourselves, then we're constantly comparing ourselves to someone else. And if we're comparing ourselves to someone else, we're kind of judging them too, right? Just say yes. Thank you. You can't fake non-judgment. The third skill comes from that place of trying to understand another person's feelings. This is difficult if we don't take the time, again, to understand our own. How many times have we thought, oh, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard? Or you shouldn't feel like that. You're okay. We think we're being helpful, right? Yeah, not so much. You know, ironically, many of us in the helping professions, and I'll try not to stare at you too long as I go through the crowd, we are in there so that we can avoid our own problems and our own stuff. We like to avoid our emotions of strife and shame, and if we focus on others and take care of them, we think we can get away from that. How many of you do that? It was just an example. While on the surface it may sound okay without being in touch with our own pain, our own self-judgment, I promise you that whether we realize it or not, that stuff leaks out into other relationships. We have to be able to be in touch with our stuff to be able to hold others when they were dealing with theirs. And finally, we need to be able to communicate our understanding. So if you're telling me a story, I need to be brave enough to say, oh, I get it. So what you're saying is, and then you would say, absolutely not. Okay, tell me again. And to be in that conversation where finally I say, oh, okay. It's being willing to be courageous and to stay in the story. This brings us back to our gospel today. Did you know that? I'd say pretty much all of the gospel stories we read about Jesus. You know, in Lent and during Holy Week, next week, I can't believe it, We have historically focused on the depravity of humankind. Have you ever heard about that before? How much we stink as human beings? Yeah. Lent has actually, or the theology behind Lent, has often alienated us from God by insisting that we are sinful, horrible individuals who require a blood sacrifice in order to be worthy of God's love, of being worthy of actually being connected to the divine. And just in case we forget it, we get to do it every year so that we get that reminder. So just when you think you're coming out of it, boom, it's back again. And it reminds us of our hideousness every year, if not in some places every Sunday. This kind of theology takes us further from God and insists that we live in a state of shame always, always. Always, always. This is not a God to whom I wish to be beholden, nor a Savior I wish to follow. In every story to which I referred to in John today, Jesus is actually acting in the opposite of this theology. Jesus shows up for the person with whom he is either confronted or relating to. There's no shame about wanting more wine for the guests. What's wrong with that? There's no shame in coming in from in the dark to hear what Jesus has to say because you're afraid. Jesus offers compassion and invitation to understanding when he hears of Nicodemus's confusion. There's no shame extended to the woman at the well, but rather deep listening and an offer for connection with the Jews and with God and with one another. There's no shame for the blind man who is told that he's blind because of his sins or the sins of his parents. In fact, Jesus in his empathy risks his own reputation to cure on the Sabbath so that this man would be free from being ostracized and instead would be brought back into his community. There's no shame for the woman brought to him in adultery. There's accountability, but no shame. And again, an invitation to community and into the embrace and the loving, caring nature of God. There's no shame in asking Jesus to restore a loved one by sisters whose grief was so great that they blamed Jesus for the death of their brother. There's no shame for the woman who would anoint Jesus with her tears and perfume, even at the scoffs and sneers of those who watched. And there's no shame attached to the fear of the disciples who would have been terrified at Jesus' pending death and the betrayal. Jesus spends time praying and comforting all of these people with whom he is in contact. You know, you might walk away thinking that maybe the message of Jesus is really about how to be empathetic in a world that tries to alienate us from one another and from God. His example, his life, his methods were and are about bringing us back. Repentance, bringing us back. Not from the shame of our sin, but from the sin of our shame. Shame that is often self or other imposed, that has no place in the relationship to which God has called us. There is no shame in our secrets. There is no shame in our addictions. There is no shame in our eating disorders. There is no shame in our missteps in our relationships or the mistakes that we make as parents. There is no shame in the abuse that we have received. There is no shame in our class, in our culture, in our race. There is no shame in how we look, in how we sound, in how we smell, in how we dress. There is no shame in our age, our job, where we live, what kind of car we drive, what kind of job we have. There is no shame. None. Wouldn't it be nice to alleviate ourselves from these things that we carry so that we can truly experience what Lent is all about? Simply understanding and experience the freedom from sin, the freedom of the sin of shame, or better known as resurrection. As we prepare for the upcoming Palm Sunday and Holy Week, I implore you to see this ritual, this remembrance, this high holy time in our church as an intimate craving, invitation, desire of our God to come back. Our God who wants nothing more than for us to know how much we are loved and how we are understood, how much our God wishes for us to love and understand one another, and our God who wants for us to be able to love and understand ourselves. Let the people say,